This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, and Burnaby. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC. Today on The Scoop, CHLY's Heather Watson in Nanaimo meets a clever little educator by the name Cora at the Mars Wildlife Rescue Center in Merville. Oh, did I mention that Cora is a raven? Near the confluence of the Nechaco and the Fraser River watershed in Prince George, a wild Chinook and sockeye salmon hatchery is plotted. CFER's Ian Gregg is on that scoop. The Kyson Regional Hospital in Terrace has quietly funded a maternity ward that will raise taxes for all residents in the Northwest, which was originally slated to be raised through fundraising. CICK News in Smithers gets their finger on the pulse. And Simon Fraser students are creating Sustainability with the R to transform old t-shirts into stylish, reusable tote bags. You're doing it with the R. The R. You know what I'm saying? Good thing CJSF's Jesse Wentzloff got an in with this tight-knit crew. CJSF's Jesse Wentzloff got an in with this tight-knit crew.
Inside the Burnaby offices of Embark Sustainability, the student-led climate and sustainability organization at Simon Fraser University, students are practicing the three R's: reduce, reuse, and recycle, by repurposing and upcycling something old into something new at the Rework, Reuse, Revolutionize climate workshop.
Making a bag. Yeah, out of a shirt.
Something about an old shirt's pattern spoke to Lukaya, a student at SFU, and soon he'll be able to carry that inspiration slung around his shoulder.
This one we got some giraffes, some tigers, some mountains. Yeah, I like tigers. So it's looking pretty sick.
One shirt was music to Fernanda's ears.
I'm working on a tote bag. Right now, the straps for the tote bag. Yeah. So it's got an old Rolling Stones t-shirt. Yeah. I just like, you know, bands, and I also saw that it was like a black tote bag, and I only have white ones, so I went for the black, and then Rolling Stones is kind of cool, so can't go wrong.
Rebecca Ballard is the Climate Equity Coordinator for Embark Sustainability.
We're doing our Rework, Reuse, Revolutionize climate equity workshop. So we're here today making tote bags out of old t-shirts that people brought in, just to show people the power of sustainable fashion and using what you already have at home versus going out to buy something new. So yeah, everyone brought in some t-shirts to make, and now everyone's just kind of making them.
Ballard says that upcycling, in this case taking old t-shirts and transforming them into tote bags, is one of many ways that individuals can live more sustainable lives and have an impact on global environmental issues.
One of the big ones is reducing like global textile waste. That is like such a prevalent issue. When you look at like garbage patches and when you look at dirty beaches full of garbage, a lot of it is textile waste. So we're working to implement solutions to that by reworking what we already have. And also reducing the human labor costs that is associated with the textile industry, like workers in Bangladesh and Vietnam and things like that, working in not so great conditions for not so great pay. So just working on sustainability from like an intersectional perspective.
According to Ballard, workshops like Rework, Reuse, Revolutionize are particularly useful for students, allowing them to build skills and relationships that will serve as lifelong tools in the fight for a sustainable future.
I think it's important for students to get involved in this way because it shows them self-sufficiency kind of skills and allows them to bring these skills into their worlds and into their circles and really permeate that knowledge to other people.
I'm learning how to machine sew. I don't really know how to machine sew a whole lot, but yeah, learning about upcycling fashion and how to make things out of other things. I thought it was a bit harder to machine sew. I'd like try to learn before and I had a tough time, but there, people have been really helpful, and it's very accessible.
I already have interest in, you know, repurposing clothes, and I just wanted to, like, you know, someone tell me that I'm doing it right or, like, not, or get some better tips on it so that I can do it on my own time. I think just, like, how easy it is to use a machine and just, like, knowing what everything is and, like, how to set it up. Like, once you kind of get it down, it's pretty simple, and I think anybody could do it.
So far, it's been really positive. Everyone's super engaged with the event, and everyone's learning to help each other because we only have one facilitator who really knows how to sew. So as we're learning, we're also teaching each other and learning how to thread machines and just working on other kinds of skills. So people have been very engaged and just receptive to the event.
Yeah, it's something I really like to look into a lot on my own time, I think. And it would be cool to, like, teach other people how to do that. So I'd want, like, to learn more about it myself.
Beyond learning how to sew with a machine and create a one-of-a-kind bespoke tote bag, participants in the Rework, Reuse, Revolutionize Climate Workshop are building an important network of like-minded climate community members.
The importance of community with sustainability is... that's how we sustain ourselves, is through community. We can't do it without community. Everyone you see succeeding has community behind them, and here we're building community in our fashion textile working shop and just really learning from each other.
From Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia, I'm Jesse Wenslaw from CJSF 90.1 FM reporting. This report is made possible by funding from the Community Radio of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative and is available online at frequencynews.ca.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca. Or CFUR.ca. The Canadian federal government has announced plans to build a new Pacific Salmon Hatchery in Prince George, Kailitane, over here in northern BC. This initiative, supported by the Pacific Salmon Strategy Initiative, or PSSI, aims to bolster the conservation and recovery of wild Chinook and sockeye salmon populations. Speaking with us today on the subject is Adam Silverstein, Regional Manager of Hatchery Reform and Modernization at the DFO, or the federal government's Department of Fisheries and Oceans. Adam, where are we at with this project here in Prince George, and what can we expect in the coming months?
Well, this is a really exciting project for those that care about the salmon resource all across BC. And what we've got is a commitment to develop a new facility that will support salmon conservation efforts. And we've got a property that's been secured and the initial construction contracts that have been tendered. We have the initial design, at least, so that we can do all the land preparation for the ultimate construction and final design when that's ready. And so we're looking forward to breaking ground as soon as weather conditions are going to allow us to do so.
Can you speak to the advantages of the selected construction location of the hatchery on the north bank of the Nechaca River, which is just near the confluence of both the Fraser and Nechaca Rivers? Are there any advantages that that location dictates?
Yeah, it's actually a very fortuitous location. We've worked with the Upper Fraser Fisheries Conservation Alliance and First Nations and Indigenous governments all across the watershed for many years to identify potentially suitable locations for a hatchery. There's lots of different requirements that play into that: access to the fish populations, the right kinds and quality and quantity of both groundwater and surface water, access to service center and employment and response times, because these are 24/7, 365-day operations. So all of those things combine and have made it quite challenging in terms of site selection. And we're fortunate that we've been able to identify this site that has access to significant quantities of groundwater and surface water and is located close to the center of Prince George. So that will allow us to be able to travel to the different watersheds to collect gametes for the hatchery and to release the juvenile fish when they're ready to go back to their native watershed. And it allows us to be in a service center where we can access staffing and other needs of a facility like this. But most importantly, it's close to the river and it's got the right quantity and quality of water that we need.
Locally, salmon have significant cultural, social, and ecological importance. The Kudli Today Nation has been dependent on salmon for generations, but as of late, this hasn't been a central factor in annual harvests. In fact, a lot of salmon stocks throughout our province are in serious long-term decline, and without action, some runs are looking like they may disappear entirely. Do you know what kind of shape our region is in? Do we fall towards the healthy end of the scale, the at-risk end, or somewhere in between? Do you think you could potentially give us a rating between 1 to 10, 10 being great, we're doing great, one being disastrous?
I'm not going to put a number on it for you. You know, I think the reason for the construction of this facility is to support the condition that a lot of stocks are in, because we are experiencing pretty severe conservation challenges across the watershed. But that being said, there are a big mix of different populations, different species, and they all have different statuses and trends. And so making one broad comment is difficult. But I think there's no doubt that across the watershed, there are a number of populations that are experiencing the challenges you've outlined. We've seen things like heat domes and different landslides and floods and other events that are creating even more challenges for these populations. And so this new facility is one of the key response measures that we are implementing to try to support these populations. And we're doing that in partnership with the Kudli Today and other First Nations across the watershed because of that cultural importance and the importance of collaboration in terms of getting the right outcome for these fish and for the people that care about them.
Speaking a little further to that, I understand this project is collaborative in nature, as a local Kudli Today First Nation is an active partner. How did that relationship develop, and what do you think it will look like as the hatchery comes online?
Well, we've been, as I said, working with local First Nation groups from the very beginning of feasibility stages of exploring this as a concept idea and where it might even be possible. And as sites were becoming narrowed down, we've been working directly with the Kudli Today First Nation on every aspect of this project. And we're working with them to define that partnership to make sure that relationship can continue in the long term. The facility is being designed to serve a broader area, though, across the watershed. And so that would include other First Nations as well. And so we're hoping, obviously, the facility is in Kudli's territory, and we're going to be working very closely with them every step of the way. But we'll also be working with other nations across the watershed in terms of what populations are ultimately brought into the hatchery.
Are there other partners involved with the project? For example, the Spruce City Wildlife Foundation runs a community hatchery here locally, and I believe they will be just on the other side of the river as this new proposed hatchery will be.
So DFO and the Salmon Enhancement Program provides direct support to the Spruce City facility. They are doing a wonderful job of stewardship in the region and educating local groups and school children and in supporting salmon populations. And we're going to continue to support their work. This facility will provide or increase our ability to collaborate with them and to provide more technical support. So that is a long-term already partnership, and will continue to expand in the future, I'm sure. The other kind of major partner for the facility at this point in time is Canfor. So Canfor does have access to groundwater and surface water already in this location. And so we're working with them to make sure we're not duplicating any infrastructure, and all the licensing and permitting for any of the water extraction is sorted. So we're really thankful for their support for this project as well.
The construction of this facility has been stated by the Honorable Diane Lebeau-Fillier, Minister of Fisheries, Oceans, and the Canadian Coast Guard, as addressing a, quote, critical infrastructure gap in the Fraser River watershed. What does the infrastructure across the Fraser River look like, and what is the DFO's plans for expanding or addressing what the infrastructure looks like there, and what's the intention?
The vast majority of our current hatchery infrastructure is close to the coast. In particular for the Fraser River, but also DFO's other, we have 23 facilities that we own and operate across the province, and another 17 facilities that we operate in partnership with First Nations or not-for-profit societies, and then a large number of kind of small volunteer stewardship facilities like the Spruce City facility. But the vast majority of especially those larger facilities are close to the coast, and in the Fraser River, they're all generally within the lower Fraser River, aside from a facility outside of Merritt and another one in the Shuswap. So there are some partner facilities. We're working with the Quesnel River Research Center as an example. There are some smaller stewardship facilities across the watershed. But in general, we don't have the hatchery infrastructure in the mid and upper Fraser River watershed to support the conservation concerns that we're seeing now. For example, when the Big Bar slide happened and there was a need to provide some emergency enhancement to support those populations, we've been transporting fish, you know, 1,000 kilometers to facilities down in the lower Fraser. And there's lots of challenges and risks and expenses associated with that. There's also a need to improve our ability to understand the life history of the fish in this part of the watershed, to improve our stock assessment data from these populations. And a facility in this location gives us a much better opportunity to do those things in a long-term sustainable way. So that's the goal of this Prince George facility, is to be able to provide that infrastructure that allows us to support the conservation, rebuilding, some experimentation and stock assessment across this part of the watershed. And we haven't had a facility of this size and nature in this part of the world to do that in the past. So there are three new hatcheries proposed as part of the Pacific Salmon Strategic Initiative, two of which will be in the Fraser River, one of which will be in the Skeena. And these are all building on our existing hatchery infrastructure, which has also received fairly significant investment in terms of upgrades and improvements as part of the PSSI. So we do have this new facility in Prince George. We have also announced a facility in partnership with the Chilcotin National Government in the Chilcotin watershed. It's a significantly smaller facility that is in partnership with the Chilcotin First Nation. And we have been doing upgrades to our other facilities in the other parts of the Fraser watershed. So our Inch Creek facility, which is one that, as an example, that has been receiving a lot of the fish from the upper Fraser in this kind of gap in infrastructure, but emergency conservation needs, has received a lot of upgrades, new groundwater wells, those types of things, to be able to facilitate its ability to continue to support conservation concerns across the watershed. And other facilities have similar examples as well. So we're working both in terms of developing new infrastructure and building on our existing infrastructure to support salmon conservation and rebuilding all across the region.
Thank you very much for your time today, Adam.
Thank you very much for helping us spread the word. We're really excited about this project. We think it's a great story of people working together for a really important thing.
Mr. Silverstein is the Regional Manager of Hatchery Reform and Modernization at the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.
When the provincial government signed the $622.6 million Kyson Regional Hospital construction contract in 2021, the Regional Hospital District agreed to pay $110.2 million as the regional taxpayer contribution to Kyson. The Northwest Regional Hospital District slated to borrow a maximum of $10 million toward the project. But a neonatal intensive care unit, or NICU, maternity ward, of 4 additional beds for expectant mothers was not included in the original plans for the hospital, which costs an additional $14.5 million. Now, this $4.5 million on the maximum amount that the hospital district could borrow has been quietly approved through debt by the hospital board. The Northwest Regional Hospital Board feels confident that the $4.5 million can be raised through fundraising, but the cost of not having the maternity ward when it came time to approve was a greater cost than the additional cost to the taxpayers. Gladys Attrell is the vice chair of the Northwest Regional Hospital District Board, and I sat down with her to discuss this project funding and the effect it will have on taxpayers in the Northwest.
So can you tell me just a little bit about the Tier 3 maternity ward at Kyson Regional Hospital? What does this unit mean for expectant mothers in the Northwest?
Having quality service available and actually being able to build that while a new hospital was being built. So kind of taking advantage of one really good situation and making it better. And so it does mean better service for people that are going to need it. And I think in terms of the timeline, the hospital had been approved. Then the request for this kind of in parallel to the hospital development. And so it was recognized it was a good idea. Mm-hmm. And so the board accepted it. And then the funding was, you know, some of it to be paid for in taxes and some of it to be paid for in fundraising.
Why wasn't this funding decision made more public?
When you have public funding and you're trying to do public fundraising, mm-hmm. it's nice for people to feel motivated for fundraising. And I think that was the gift that the foundation was offering, as we're going to try to work with the community to raise some money that way as well. Mm-hmm. So now as we're going through budget process, we'll see. But at the same time, being able to get an additional facility well needed, that will be well used, that will last for a very long time, is still worth it. And I think sometimes, you know, if we hold fast to our budget and say we're not going to take advantage of this opportunity, on balance, the public is not well served, because mm-hmm. something, you know, building things simultaneously makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. How will taxpayers in the Northwest be affected by this increase in this budget line?
Well, it's a couple of things. So there's the gross cost of the hospital, yeah. and then there's the amount that we pay for as the taxpayers within the regional hospital district. You know, it's a lot of money, but it's still a pretty good deal. So the general rule of division of how things are paid for is about 60-40. So when we agree to a new project, a new hospital, if I use easy numbers, if it cost $1 million mm-hmm. and they cost way more than that, 60% would be borne by the province, 40% by the local taxpayer. So the new hospital in Terrace is worth quite a bit more than that. Mm-hmm. And we, the board, prior to my being there, had negotiated at about a 20% rate with a rate cap. So the actual tax amount to the local taxpayers was a much better rate mm-hmm. than the normal 60-40. So then when the additional request comes for the special project, it's an additional amount of tax, yes. It's small compared to the gross project, mm-hmm. but yes, there is an additional tax requisition that goes for the neonatal unit.
Mm-hmm. On average, from districts across the Northwest, from Haida Gwaii to Houston, the average taxpayer will pay an additional $6.84 a year until 2049 for the neonatal intensive care unit addition.
Overall, it's still a very good deal. It's going to last for a long time. You know, we think about our private debt. You want to pay things off as quick as possible. You're the payer and you're the beneficiary. You sort that out how it makes sense mm-hmm. for you. But big public infrastructure is going to last for decades.
But at the end of the day, it's how the board deals with budget issues. Right. So we'll know what that means if something comes to the board and there's a request made and the board makes a decision. That's when we actually know. So the board does have the authority to set the budget, and budgets can be amended anytime.
Right.
But we're in budget season now, so yeah. we'll see what comes before the board, and the board meets this weekend.
Thank you so much, Gladys.
Well, thanks, Pam.
This is ACHLY and CVOX News Update. Mars Wildlife Rescue Center in Merville is building a new muse for resident raven Cora. Ambassador animals such as Cora are ones that cannot be released back to the wild due to their injuries and are docile enough to be safe with guests who visit the rescue center to learn about wildlife. According to an update on the Mars website, the injured raven was brought to the center when she was in need of intense rehabilitation, and after months of care was deemed unreleasable by vets due to her poor eyesight. Because the raven was found to be docile and curious towards humans, the center says staff decided she would be a good fit for their ambassador program in early 2024 and gave her the name Cora. Now Mars is beginning production on a large habitat for the raven to live in. The muse construction began on Monday with a volunteer party to clear ground, remove invasive plant species, and pour a concrete foundation. The next step will be another work party to build a fence. Progress will continue into the spring, and the full project is expected to be completed in about 3 months. Mars started as an exclusively avian rescue center, but expanded beyond birds to all wildlife when current director Warren Wartig brought his experience to the team. Wartig says the rescue center has one simple rule for who not to take in.
general rule of thumb, if it can kill you, then we don't try and capture them.
While the goal of the rescue center is to heal and release wild animals, not every creature is able to be helped. And of those that survive, not all are safe for release. Wartig says the average survival rate for wildlife care hospitals across Canada is 30%, and that Mars has achieved 33%, which he says is remarkable.
Especially with birds, if you can capture a large bird like an eagle or a hawk by hand, that means they've been injured or sick for a very long period of time, and they just fluff themselves up to look like they're still healthy and tough.
Wartig says that 2024 was a particularly difficult year with the avian flu, something that is picked up during migration and easily transmitted between animals, so those numbers may be down. Wartig says that education is a major part of the work done at Mars.
At least half of our mandate is education.
He says that ambassador animals like the raven Cora increase that education.
We've had 3- and 4-year-olds name off all of our ambassador birds and come back and remember them and ask about them. So it's quite heartwarming sometimes.
From helping to construct new habitats like Cora's raven Muse to raising mealworms or washing laundry, Wartig says there is always lots for volunteers to do. Mars Rescue says if you find an animal you think is injured, don't touch. Wait, watch, call. Details of what to watch for can be found on the Mars website, and if you find an animal you believe to be in distress, the center urges citizens to call the Mars helpline at 250-337-2021 before attempting a rescue. People interested in volunteering, booking a tour, or learning more about the raven Cora and protecting local wildlife can find more information online at marswildliferescue.com or on the Mars Wildlife Rescue Center Facebook page. For CHLY and CVOX News, this is Heather Watson.
This report, in partnership with CVOX, was made possible with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs program, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, and weekdays at 7:30 a.m. in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.